clapped. For the lone man, few of the crowd had seen him in the flesh. All of them had seen him 100 times in press pictures, photographed among litters of books in his study, photographed in conference with President Roosevelt and Secretary Ickes, photographed shaking hands with Senator Windrip, photographed before a microphone, his shrieking mouth a dark open trap and his lean right arm thrown up in hysterical emphasis. All of them had heard his voice on the radio till they knew it as they knew the voices of their own brothers. All of them recognized, coming through the wide main entrance at the end of the Windrip parade, the Apostle of the Forgotten Men, Bishop Paul Peter Prang. Then the convention cheered Buzz Windrip for 4 unbroken hours. In the detailed descriptions of the convention which the news bureaus sent following the feverish first bulletins, one energetic Birmingham reporter pretty well proved that the Southern battle flag carried by the Confederate veteran had been lent by the museum in Richmond, and the Northern flag by a distinguished meat packer of Chicago who was the grandson of a Civil War general. Lee Saracen never told anyone save Buzz Windrip that both flags had been manufactured on Hester Street, New York, in 1929 for the patriotic drama Morgan's Riding, and that both came from a theatrical warehouse. Before the cheering, as the Windrip parade near the platform, they were greeted by Mrs. Adelaide Tarr Gimmich, the celebrated author, lecturer, and composer who, suddenly conjured onto the platform as if whisked out of the air, sang to the tune of Yankee Doodle words which she herself had written. Berzelius Windrip went to wash, a-riding on a hobby, to throw big business out, by gosh, and be the people's lobby. Chorus. Buzz and buzz and keep it up, our cares and needs he's toting. You are a most ungrateful pup, unless for Buzz you're voting. The League of the Forgotten Men don't like to be forgotten. They went to Washington, and then they sang, There's Something Rotten. That joyous battle song was sung on the radio by 19 different prima donnas before midnight, by some 16 million less vocal Americans within 48 hours, and by at least 90 million friends and scoffers in the struggle that was to come. All through the campaign, Buzz Windrip was able to get lots of jolly humor out of puns on going to wash and to wash. Walt Trowbridge, he jeered, wasn't going to either of them. Yet Lee Saracen knew that in addition to this comic masterpiece, the cause of Windrip required an anthem more elevated in thought and spirit, befitting the seriousness of crusading Americans. Long after the convention's cheering for Windrip had ended, and the delegates were again at their proper business of saving the nation and cutting one another's throats, Saracen had Mrs. Gimmich sing a more inspirational hymn, with words by Saracen himself, in collaboration with a quite remarkable surgeon, one Dr. Hector McGoblin. This Dr. McGoblin, soon to become a national monument, was as accomplished in syndicated medical journalism, in the reviewing of books about education and psychoanalysis, in preparing glosses upon the philosophies of Hegel, Professor Gunther, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, and Lothrop Stoddard, in the rendition of Mozart on the violin, in semi-professional boxing, and in the composition of epic poetry, as he was in the practice of medicine. Dr. McGoblin, what a man! The Saracen McGoblin ode, entitled Bring Out the Old-Time Musket, became to Buzz Windrip's band of liberators what Giovinezza was to the Italians, the horse vessel song to the Nazis, the international to all Marxians. Along with the convention, the radio millions heard Mrs. Adelaide Tarr Gimmich's contralto, Rich as Pete, chanting, Bring out the old-time musket. Dear Lord, we have sinned, we have slumbered, and our flag lies stained in the dust, and the souls of the past are calling, calling, arise from your sloth, you must. Lead us, O soul of Lincoln, inspire us, Spirit of Lee. to rule all the world for righteousness, to fight for the right, to all with our might, as we did in 63. Chorus. See, youth with desire hot glowing, see, maiden with fearless eye, leading our ranks, thunder the tanks, aeroplanes cloud the sky. Bring out the old-time musket, rouse up the old-time fire. See, all the world is crumbling, dreadful and dark and dire. America, rise and conquer, the world to our heart's desire. Great showmanship. P.T. Barnum or Flo Ziegfeld never put on a better, mused Doremus as he studied the A.P. flimsies, as he listened to the radio he had had temporarily installed in his office. And much later, when Buzz gets in, he won't be having any parade of wounded soldiers. That'll be bad fascist psychology. All those poor devils he'll hide away in institutions and just bring out the lively young human slaughter cattle in uniforms. The thunderstorm, which had mercifully lulled, burst again in wrathful menace. All afternoon the convention balloted over and over, with no change in the order of votes for the presidential candidate. Toward 6, Miss Perkins's manager threw her votes to Roosevelt, who gained then on Senator Windrip. They seemed to have settled down to an all-night struggle, and at 10 in the evening, Doremus wearily left the office. He did not tonight want the sympathetic and extremely feminized atmosphere of his home, and he dropped in at the rectory of his friend, Father Perifix. There he found a satisfyingly unfeminized, untalcumized group. The Reverend Mr. Falk was there. Swart, sturdy young Perifix and silvery old Falk often worked together, were fond of each other, and agreed upon the advantages of clerical celibacy and almost every other doctrine except the supremacy of the Bishop of Rome. With them were Buck Titus, Louis Rotenstern, Dr. Fowler Greenhill, and banker Crowley, a financier who liked to cultivate an appearance of free intellectual discussion, though only after the hours devoted to refusing credit to desperate farmers and storekeepers. And not to be forgotten was Foolish the Dog, who that thunderous morning had suspected his master's worry, followed him to the office, and all day long had growled at Hake and Saracen and Mrs. Gimmich on the radio, and showed an earnest conviction that he ought to chew up all flimsies reporting the convention. Better than his own glacial white-paneled drawing-room with its portraits of dead Vermont worthies, Doremus liked Father Perifix's little study, and its combination of churchliness, of freedom from commerce, at least ordinary commerce, as displayed in a crucifix and a plaster statuette of the Virgin and a shrieking red and green Italian picture of the Pope, with practical affairs, as shown in the oak roll-top desk and steel filing cabinet and well-worn portable typewriter. It was a pious hermit's cave with the advantages of leather chairs and excellent rye highballs. The night passed as the 8 of them, for Foolish too had his tipple of milk, all sipped and listened. The night passed as the convention balloted, furiously, unavailingly, that Congress, 600 miles away, 600 miles of befogged night, yet with every speech, every derisive yelp, coming into the priest's cabinet in the same second in which they were heard in the hall at Cleveland. Father Perifix's housekeeper, who was 65 years old to his 39, to the disappointment of all the scandal-loving local Protestants, came in with scrambled eggs, cold beer. "When my dear wife was still among us, she used to send me to bed at midnight," sighed Dr. Falk. "My wife does now," said Doremus. "So does mine, and her a New York girl," said Louis Rotenstern. "Father Steve here and I are the only guys with a sensible way of living," crowed Buck Titus. "Celibates! We can go to bed with our pants on or not go to bed at all." And Father Perifix murmured, "But it's curious, Buck, what people find to boast of. You, that you're free of God's tyranny, and also that you can go to bed in your pants. Mr. Falk and Dr. Greenhill and I, that God is so lenient with us that Some nights he lets us off from sick calls, and we can go to bed with them off. And Lewis, because, listen, listen, sounds like business. Colonel Dewey Hake, Buzz's proposer, was announcing that Senator Windrip felt it would be only modest of him to go to his hotel now, but he had left a letter which he, Hake, would read. And he did read it, inexorably. Windrip stated that just in case anyone did not completely understand his platform, he wanted to make it all ringingly clear. Summarized, the letter explained that he was all against the banks, but all for the bankers, except the Jewish bankers, who were to be driven out of finance entirely, that he had thoroughly tested, but unspecified, plans to make all wages very high and the prices of everything produced by these same highly paid workers very low, that he was 100% for labor, but 100% against all strikes, and that he was in favor of the United States so arming itself, so preparing to produce its own coffee, sugar, perfumes, tweeds, and nickel instead of importing them, that it could defy the world, and maybe, if that world was so impertinent as to defy America in turn, Buzz hinted, he might have to take it over and run it properly. Each moment the brassy importunities of the radio seemed to Doremus the more offensive, while the hillside slept in the heavy summer night, and he thought about the mazurka of the fireflies, the rhythm of crickets like the rhythm of the revolving earth itself, the voluptuous breezes that bore away the stink of cigars and sweat and whiskey breaths and mint-chewing gum that seemed to come to them from the convention over the sound waves, along with the oratory. It was after dawn, and Father Perifix, unclerically stripped to shirt sleeves and slippers, had just brought them in a grateful tray of onion soup, with a gob of Hamburg steak for Foolish, when the opposition to Buzz collapsed, and hastily on the next ballot, Senator Berzelius Windrip was nominated as Democratic candidate for President of the United States. Doremus, Buck Titus, Perifix, and Falk were for a time too gloomy for speech. So possibly was the dog Foolish as well, for at the turning off of the radio he tail-thumped in only the most tentative way. R.C. Crowley gloated, "Well, all my life I voted Republican, but here's a man that, well, I'm going to vote for Windrip." Father Perifix said tartly, "And I voted Democratic ever since I came from Canada and got naturalized, but this time I'm going to vote Republican. What about you fellows?" Rotenstern was silent. He did not like Windrip's reference to Jews. The ones he knew best? No, they were Americans. Lincoln was his tribal god, too, he vowed. "Me? I'll vote for Walt Trowbridge, of course," growled Buck. "So will I," said Doremus. "No, I won't either. Trowbridge won't have a chance. I think I'll indulge in the luxury of being independent for once and vote Prohibition or the Battle Creek Bran and Spinach ticket, or anything that makes some sense." It was after 7 that morning when Doremus came home, and, remarkably enough, Shad Ledoux, who was supposed to go to work at 7, was at work at 7. Normally he never left his bachelor shack in Lower Town till 7:50, but this morning he was on the job chopping kindling. Oh yes, reflected Doremus. That probably explained it. Kindling chopping, if practiced early enough, would wake up everyone in the house. Shad was tall and hulking. His shirt was sweat-stained, and as usual he needed a shave. Foolish growled at him. Doremus suspected that at some time he had been kicking Foolish. He wanted to honor Shad for the sweaty shirt, the honest toil, and all the rugged virtues, but even as a liberal American humanitarian, Doremus found it hard always to keep up the Longfellow's Village blacksmith cum Marx attitude consistently, and not sometimes backslide into a belief that there must be some crooks and swine among the toilers, as notoriously there were so shockingly many among persons with more than $3,500 a year. "Well, been sitting up listening to the radio," purred Doremus. "Did you know the Democrats have nominated Senator Windrip?" "That's so," Chad growled. Yes, just now. How are you planning to vote? Well, now, I'll tell you, Mr. Jessup. Chad struck an attitude, leaning on his axe. Sometimes he could be quite pleasant and condescending, even to this little man who was so ignorant about coon hunting and the games of craps and poker. I'm going to vote for Buzz Windrip. He's going to fix it so everybody will get $4,000 immediate, and I'm going to start a chicken farm. I can make a bunch of money out of chickens. I'll show some of these guys that think they're so rich. But, Chad, you didn't have so much luck with chickens when you tried to raise them in the shed back there. I'm afraid you sort of let their water freeze up on them in winter, and they all died, you remember. Oh, them, so what, heck. There was too few of them. I'm not going to waste my time fooling with just a couple dozen chickens. When I get 5,000-6,000 of them to make it worth my while, then I'll show you. You bet. And most patronizingly, Buzz Windrip is okay. I'm glad he has your imprimatur. Huh, said Shad and scowled. But as Doremus plodded up on the back porch, he heard from Shad a faint, derisive, Okay, chief. Chapter 8 I don't pretend to be a very educated man, except maybe educated in the heart, and in being able to feel for the sorrows and fear of every ornery fellow human being. Still and all, I've read the Bible through from kiver to kiver, like my wife's folks say down in Arkansas, some 11 times. I've read all the law books they've printed, and as to contemporaries, I don't guess I've missed much of all the grand literature produced by Bruce Barton, Edgar Guest, Arthur Brisbane, Elizabeth Dilling, Walter Pitkin, and William Dudley Pelley. This last gentleman I honor not only for his rattling good yarns and his serious work in investigating life beyond the grave and absolutely proving that only a blind fool could fail to believe in personal immortality, but finally for his public-spirited and self-sacrificing work in founding the Silver Shirts. These true knights, even if they did not attain quite all the success they deserved, were one of our most noble and Galahad-like attempts to combat the sneaking, snaky, sinister, surreptitious, seditious plots of the Red Radicals and other sour brands of Bolsheviks that incessantly threaten the American standards of liberty, high wages, and universal security. These fellows have messages, and we haven't got time for anything in literature except a straight, hard-hitting, heart-throbbing message. 0 hour. Berzelius Windrip. During the very first week of his campaign, Senator Windrip clarified his philosophy by issuing his distinguished proclamation, the 15 points of victory for the forgotten men. The 15 planks, in his own words, or maybe in Lee Saracen's words, or Dewey Hake's words, were these. 1. All finance in the country, including banking, insurance, stocks and bonds and mortgages, shall be under the absolute control of a federal central bank, owned by the government and conducted by a board appointed by the president, which board shall, without need of recourse to Congress for legislative authorization, be empowered to make all regulations governing finance. Thereafter, as soon as may be practicable, this said board shall consider the nationalization and government ownership for the profit of the whole people, of all mines, oil fields, water power, public utilities, transportation, and communication. 2. The president shall appoint a commission, equally divided between manual workers, employers, and representatives of the public, to determine which labor unions are qualified to represent the workers, and report to the executive for legal action all pretended labor organizations, whether company unions or red unions, controlled by communists and the so-called Third International. The duly recognized unions shall be constituted bureaus of the government, with power of decision in all labor disputes. Later, the same investigation and official recognition shall be extended to farm organizations. In this elevation of the position of the worker, It shall be emphasized that the League of Forgotten Men is the chief bulwark against the menace of destructive and un-American radicalism. 3. In contradistinction to the doctrines of red radicals, with their felonious expropriation of the arduously acquired possessions which ensure to aged persons their security, this league and party will guarantee private initiative and the right to private property for all time. 4. Believing that only under God Almighty, to whom we render all homage, do we Americans hold our vast power, we shall guarantee to all persons absolute freedom of religious worship, provided, however, that no atheist, agnostic, believer in black magic, nor any Jew who shall refuse to swear allegiance to the New Testament, nor any person of any faith who refuses to take the pledge to the flag, shall be permitted to hold any public office or to practice as a teacher, professor, lawyer, judge, or as a physician, except in the category of obstetrics. 5. Annual net income per person shall be limited to $500,000. No accumulated fortune may at any one time exceed $3 million per person. No one person shall, during his entire lifetime, be permitted to retain an inheritance or various inheritances in total exceeding $2 million. All incomes or estates in excess of the sums named shall be seized by the federal government for use in relief and in administrative expenses. 6. Profit shall be taken out of war by seizing all dividends over and above 6% that shall be received from the manufacture, distribution, or sale during wartime of all arms, munitions, aircraft, ships, tanks, and all other things directly applicable to warfare, as well as from food, textiles, and all other supplies furnished to the American or to any allied army. 7. Our armaments and the size of our military and naval establishments shall be consistently enlarged until they shall equal, but, since this country has no desire for foreign conquest of any kind, not surpass, in every branch of the forces of defense, the martial strength of any other single country or empire in the world. Upon inauguration, this league and party shall make this its first obligation, together with the issuance of a firm proclamation to all nations of the world, that our armed forces are to be maintained solely for the purpose of ensuring world peace and amity. 8. Congress shall have the sole right to issue money, and immediately upon our inauguration, it shall at least double the present supply of money in order to facilitate the fluidity of credit. 9. We cannot too strongly condemn the unchristian attitude of certain otherwise progressive nations in their discriminations against the Jews, who have been among the strongest supporters of the League and who will continue to prosper and to be recognized as fully Americanized, though only so long as they continue to support our ideals. 10. All Negroes shall be prohibited from voting, holding public office, practicing law, medicine, or teaching in any class above the grade of grammar school, and they shall be taxed 100% of all sums in excess of $10,000 per family per year, which they may earn or in any other manner receive. In order, however, to give the most sympathetic aid possible to all Negroes who comprehend their proper and valuable place in society, all such colored persons, male or female, as can prove that they have devoted not less than 45 years to such suitable tasks as domestic service, agricultural labor, and common labor and industries, shall at the age of 65 be permitted to appear before a special board composed entirely of white persons, and upon proof that while employed they have never been idle except through sickness, they shall be recommended for pensions not to exceed the sum of $500 per person per year, nor to exceed $700 per family. Negroes shall, by definition, be persons with at least 1/16 colored blood. 11. Far from opposing such high-minded and economically sound methods of the relief of poverty, unemployment, and old age as the epic plan of the Honorable Upton Sinclair, the share the wealth and every man a king proposals of the late Honorable Huey Long, to assure every family $5,000 a year. The Townsend Plan, the Utopian Plan, technocracy, and all competent schemes of unemployment insurance. A commission shall immediately be appointed by the new administration to study, reconcile, and recommend for immediate adoption the best features in these several plans for Social Security, and the Honorable Messrs. Sinclair, Townsend, Eugene Reed, and Howard Scott are herewith invited to in every way advise and collaborate with that commission. 12. All women now employed shall, as rapidly as possible, except in such peculiarly feminine spheres of activity as nursing and beauty parlors, be assisted to return to their incomparably sacred duties as homemakers and as mothers of strong, honorable future citizens of the Commonwealth. 13. Any person advocating communism, socialism, or anarchism, advocating refusal to enlist in case of war, or advocating alliance with Russia in any war whatsoever, shall be subject to trial for high treason, with a minimum penalty of 20 years at hard labor in prison and a maximum of death on the gallows or other form of execution which the judges may find convenient. 14. All bonuses promised to former soldiers of any war in which America has ever engaged shall be immediately paid in full, in cash, and in all cases of veterans with incomes of less than $5,000 a year, the formerly promised sums shall be doubled. 15. Congress shall, immediately upon our inauguration, initiate amendments to the Constitution providing, A, that the President shall have the authority to institute and execute all necessary measures for the conduct of the government, during this critical epoch, B, that Congress shall serve only in an advisory capacity, calling to the attention of the President and his aides and cabinet any needed legislation, but not acting upon same until authorized by the President so to act, and C, that the Supreme Court shall immediately have removed from its jurisdiction the power to negate, by ruling them to be unconstitutional, or by any other judicial action, any or all acts of the President, his duly appointed aides, or Congress. Addendum. It shall be strictly understood that as the League of Forgotten Men and the Democratic Party is now constituted, have no purpose nor desire to carry out any measure that shall not unqualifiedly meet with the desire of the majority of voters in these United States, the League and Party regard none of the above 15 points as obligatory and unmodifiable, except number 15, and upon the others they will act or refrain from acting in accordance with the general desire of the public, who shall, under the new regime, be again granted an individual freedom of which they have been deprived by the harsh and restrictive economic measures of former administrations, both Republican and Democratic. "But what does it mean?" marveled Mrs. Jessup when her husband had read the platform to her. "It's so inconsistent. Sounds like a combination of Norman Thomas and Calvin Coolidge. I don't seem to understand it. I wonder if Mr. Windrip understands it himself." "Sure, you bet he does. It mustn't be supposed that because Windrip gets that intellectual dressmaker Saracen to prettify his ideas up for him, he doesn't recognize them and clasp them to his bosom when they're dolled up in $2 words. I'll tell you just what it all means. Articles 1 and 5 mean that if the financiers and transportation kings and so on don't come through heavily with support for Buzz, they may be threatened with bigger income taxes and some control of their businesses. But they are coming through, I hear, handsomely. They're paying for Buzz's radio and his parades. 2, that by controlling their unions directly, Buzz's gang can kidnap all labor into slavery. 3, backs up the security for big capital, and 4, brings the preachers into line as scared and unpaid press agents for Buzz. 6 doesn't mean anything at all. Munition firms with vertical trusts will be able to wangle 1/6% on manufacture, 1 on transportation, and 1 on sales, at least. 7 means we'll get ready to follow all the European nations in trying to hog the whole world. 8 means that by inflation, big industrial companies will be able to buy their outstanding bonds back at a cent on the dollar. And 9, that all Jews who don't cough up plenty of money for the robber baron will be punished, even including the Jews who haven't much to cough up. 10, that all well-paying jobs and businesses held by Negroes will be grabbed by the poor white trash among Buzz's worshippers, and that instead of being denounced, they'll be universally praised as patriotic protectors of racial purity. 11, that Buzz will be able to pass the buck for not creating any real relief for poverty. 12, that women will later lose the vote and the right to higher education and be foxed out of all decent jobs and urged to rear soldiers to be killed in foreign wars. 13, that anybody who opposes Buzz in any way at all can be called a communist and scragged for it. Why, under this clause, Hoover and Al Smith and Ogden Mills, yes, and you and me, will all be communists. 14, that Buzz thinks enough of the support of the veterans' vote to be willing to pay high for it, in other people's money. And 15, well, that's the one loan clause that really does mean something, and it means that Windrip and Lee Saracen and Bishop Prang and I guess maybe this Colonel Dewey Hake and this Dr. Hector McGoblin, you know, this doctor that helps write the high-minded hymns for Buzz, they realize that this country has gone so flabby that any gang daring enough and unscrupulous enough and smart enough not to seem illegal can grab hold of the entire government and have all the power and applause and salutes, all the money and palaces and willin' women they want. They're only a handful, but just think how small Lenin's gang was at first, and Mussolini's and Hitler's and Kemal Pasha's and Napoleon's. You'll see all the liberal preachers and modernist educators and discontented newspapermen and farm agitators. Maybe they'll worry at first, but they'll get caught up in the web of propaganda like we all were in the Great War. And they'll all be convinced that even if our Buzzy maybe has got a few faults, he's on the side of the plain people and against all the tight old political machines, and they'll rouse the country for him as the great liberator. And meanwhile, big business will just wink and sit tight. And then, by God, this crook, oh, I don't know whether he's more of a crook or an hysterical religious fanatic, along with Saracen and Hake and Prang and McGoblin, these 5 men will be able to set up a regime that'll remind you of Henry Morgan, the pirate, capturing a merchant ship. But will Americans stand for it long? Whimpered Emma. Oh, no, not people like us, the descendants of the pioneers. Dunno. I'm going to try help see that they don't. Of course, you understand that you and I and Sissy and Fowler and Mary will probably be shot if I do try to do anything. I sound brave enough now, but probably I'll be scared to death when I hear Buzz's private troops go marching by. Oh, you will be careful, won't you? Begged Emma. Oh, before I forget it, how many times must I tell you, Dormouse, not to give foolish chicken bones? They'll stick in his poor throat and choke him to death. And you just never remember to take the keys out of the car when you put it in the garage at night. I'm perfectly sure Shad LaDue or somebody will steal it one of these nights. Father Stephen Perifix, when he read the 15 points, was considerably angrier than Doremus. He snorted, "What? Negroes, Jews, women? They all banned and they leave us Catholics out this time? Hitler didn't neglect us. He's persecuted us. Must be that Charlie Coughlin. He's made us too respectable." Sissy, who was eager to go to a school of architecture and become a creator of new styles in houses of glass and steel, Lorinda Pike, who had plans for a Carlsbad, Vichy, Saratoga in Vermont, Mrs. Candy, who aspired to a home bakery of her own when she should be too old for domestic labor. They were all of them angrier than either Doremus or Father Perifix. Sissy sounded not like a flirtatious girl, but like a battling woman as she snarled, "So the League of Forgotten Men is going to make us a League of Forgotten Women. Send us back to washing diapers and leaching out ashes for soap. Let us read Louisa May Alcott and Barn, except on the Sabbath, of course. Let us sleep in humble gratitude with men." "Sissy," wailed her mother. like Shad Ledoux. Well, Dad, you can sit right down and write Busy Berzelius for me that I'm going to England on the next boat. Mrs. Candy stopped drying the water glasses with the soft dish towels, which she scrupulously washed out daily, long enough to croak, "What nasty men! I do hope they get shot soon," which for Mrs. Candy was a startlingly long and humanitarian statement. Yes, nasty enough, but what I've got to keep remembering is that Windrip is only the lightest cork on the whirlpool. He didn't plot all this thing. With all the justified discontent there is against the smart politicians and the plush horses of plutocracy, oh, if it hadn't been one Windrip, it had been another. We had it coming, we respectables, but that isn't going to make us like it, thought Doremus. Chapter 9. Those who have never been on the inside in the councils of state can never realize that with really high-class statesmen, their chief quality is not political canniness, but a big, rich, overflowing love for all sorts and conditions of people and for the whole land. That love and that patriotism have been my sole guiding principles in politics. My one ambition is to get all Americans to realize that they are, and must continue to be, the greatest race on the face of this old earth. And second, to realize that whatever apparent differences there may be among us, in wealth, knowledge, skill, ancestry, or strength, though of course all this does not apply to people who are racially different from us, we are all brothers, bound together in the great and wonderful bond of national unity, for which we should all be very glad. And I think we ought to, for this, be willing to sacrifice any individual gains at all. 0 hour. Berzelius Windrip. Berzelius Windrip, of whom in late summer and early autumn of 1936 there were so many published photographs, showing him popping into cars and out of aeroplanes, dedicating bridges, eating corn pone and side meat with Southerners and clam chowder and bran with Northerners, addressing the American Legion, the Liberty League, the YMHA, the Young People's Socialist League, the Elks, the Bartenders and Waiters Union, the Anti-Saloon League, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Afghanistan, showing him kissing lady centenarians and shaking hands with ladies called Madam, but never the opposite, showing him in Savile Row riding clothes on Long Island and in overalls and a khaki shirt in the Ozarks. This Buzz Windrip was almost a dwarf, yet with an enormous head, a bloodhound head of huge ears, pendulous cheeks, mournful eyes. He had a luminous, ungrudging smile which, declared the Washington correspondents, he turned on and off deliberately like an electric light, but which could make his ugliness more attractive than the simpers of any pretty man. His hair was so coarse and black and straight and worn so long in the back that it hinted of Indian blood. In the Senate he preferred clothes that suggested the competent insurance salesman, but when farmer constituents were in Washington he appeared in an historic 10-gallon hat with a mussy gray cutaway, which somehow you erroneously remembered as a black Prince Albert. In that costume he looked like a sawed-off museum model of a medicine show doctor, and indeed it was rumored that during one law school vacation Buzz Windrip had played the banjo and done card tricks and handed down medicine bottles and managed the shell game for no less scientific an expedition than old Dr. Allagash's traveling laboratory, which specialized in the Choctaw cancer cure, the Chinook consumption soother, and the oriental remedy for piles and rheumatism prepared from a world-old secret formula by the gypsy princess, Queen Peshawara. The company, ardently assisted by Buzz, killed off quite a number of persons who, but for their confidence in Dr. Allagash's bottles of water, coloring matter, tobacco juice, and raw corn whiskey, might have gone early enough to doctors. But since then, Windrip had redeemed himself, no doubt, by ascending from the vulgar fraud of selling bogus medicine, standing in front of a megaphone, to the dignity of selling bogus economics, standing on an indoor platform under mercury vapor lights in front of a microphone. He was in stature but a small man, yet remember that so were Napoleon, Lord Beaverbrook, Stephen A. Douglas, Frederick the Great, and the Dr. Goebbels, who was privily known throughout Germany as Wotan's Mickey Mouse. Doremus Jessup, so inconspicuous an observer, watching Senator Windrip from so humble a boeotia, could not explain his power of bewitching large audiences. The senator was vulgar, almost illiterate, a public liar easily detected, and in his ideas almost idiotic, while his celebrated piety was that of a traveling salesman for church furniture, and his yet more celebrated humor the sly cynicism of a country store. Certainly there was nothing exhilarating in the actual words of his speeches, nor anything convincing in his philosophy. His political platforms were only wings of a windmill. 7 years before his present credo, derived from Lee Saracen, Hitler, Gottfried Feder, Rocco, and probably the review of V.I. Singh, Little Buzz, back home, had advocated nothing more revolutionary than better beef stew in the country poor farms, and plenty of graft for loyal machine politicians, with jobs for their brothers-in-law, nephews, law partners, and creditors. Doremus had never heard Windrip during one of his orgasms of oratory, but he had been told by political reporters that, under the spell, you thought Windrip was Plato, but that on the way home, you could not remember anything he had said. There were two things, they told Doremus, that distinguished this prairie Demosthenes. He was an actor of genius. There was no more overwhelming actor on the stage, in the motion pictures, nor even in the pulpit. He would whirl arms, bang tables, glare from mad eyes, vomit biblical wrath from a gaping mouth. But he would also coo like a nursing mother, beseech like an aching lover, and in between tricks would coldly and almost contemptuously jab his crowds with figures and facts. Figures and facts that were inescapable, even when, as often happened, they were entirely incorrect. But below this surface stagecraft was his uncommon natural ability to be authentically excited by and with his audience, and they by and with him. He could dramatize his assertion that he was neither a Nazi nor a fascist, but a Democrat, a homespun Jeffersonian, Lincolnian, Clevelandian, Wilsonian Democrat, and, sans scenery and costume, make you see him veritably defending the capital against barbarian hordes, the while he innocently presented as his own warm-hearted democratic inventions every anti-libertarian, anti-Semitic madness of Europe. Aside from his dramatic glory, Buzz Windrip was a professional common man. Oh, he was common enough. He had every prejudice and aspiration of every American common man. He believed in the desirability and therefore the sanctity of thick buckwheat cakes with adulterated maple syrup, in rubber trays for the ice cubes in his electric refrigerator, in the especial nobility of dogs, all dogs, in the oracles of S. Parks Cadman, in being chummy with all waitresses at all junction lunchrooms, and in Henry Ford. When he became president, he exulted, maybe he could get Mr. Ford to come to supper at the White House. And the superiority of anyone who possessed $1 million. He regarded spats, walking sticks, caviar, titles, tea drinking, poetry not daily syndicated in newspapers, and all foreigners, possibly excepting the British, as degenerate. But he was the common man 20 times magnified by his oratory, so that while the other commoners could understand his every purpose, which was exactly the same as their own, they saw him towering among them, and they raised hands to him in worship. In the greatest of all Native American arts, next to the talkies and those spirituals in which Negroes express their desire to go to heaven, to St. Louis, or almost any place distant from the romantic old plantations, namely, in the art of publicity, Lee Saracen was in no way inferior even to such acknowledged masters as Edward Bernays, the late Theodore Roosevelt, Jack Dempsey, and Upton Sinclair. Saracen had, as was scientifically called, been building up Senator Windrip for 7 years before his nomination as president. Where other senators were encouraged by their secretaries and wives, no potential dictator ought ever to have a visible wife, and none ever has had except Napoleon, to expand from village backslapping to noble, rotund Ciceronian gestures, Saracen had encouraged Windrip to keep up in the great world all of the clownishness which, along with considerable legal shrewdness and the endurance to make 10 speeches a day, had endeared him to his simple-hearted constituents in his native state. Windrip danced a hornpipe before an alarmed academic audience when he got his first honorary degree. He kissed Miss Flandreau at the South Dakota Beauty Contest. He entertained the Senate, or at least the Senate galleries, with detailed accounts of how to catch catfish, from the bait digging to the ultimate effects of the jug of corn whiskey. He challenged the venerable Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to a duel with slingshots. Though she was not visible, Windrip did have a wife. Saracen had none, nor was likely to, and Walt Trowbridge was a widower. Buzz's lady stayed back home, raising spinach and chickens, and telling the neighbors that she expected to go to Washington next year, the while Windrip was informing the press that his Frau was so edifyingly devoted to their 2 small children and a Bible study that she simply could not be coaxed to come east. But when it came to assembling a political machine, Windrip had no need of counsel from Lee Saracen. Where Buzz was, there were the vultures also. His hotel suite in the capital city of his home state, in Washington, in New York, or in Kansas City, was like, well, Frank Sullivan once suggested that it resembled the office of a tabloid newspaper upon the impossible occasion of Bishop Cannon's setting fire to St. Patrick's Cathedral, kidnapping the Dion quintuplets, and eloping with Greta Garbo in a stolen tank. In the parlor of any of these suites, Buzz Windrip sat in the middle of the room, a telephone on the floor beside him, and for hours he shrieked at the instrument. "Hello? Yeah, speaking?" Or at the door. "Come in, come in," and "Sit down and take a load off your feet." All day, all night, till dawn, he would be bellowing, "Tell him he can take his bill and go climb a tree," or, "Why, certainly, old man, tickled to death to support it. Utility corporation's certainly been getting a raw deal." And, "You tell the governor I want Kippy elected sheriff, and I want the indictment against him quashed, and I want it damn quick." Usually, squatted there cross-legged, he would be wearing a smart belted camel's hair coat with an atrocious checked cap. In a fury, as he was at least every quarter hour, he would leap up, peel off the overcoat, showing either a white-boiled shirt and clerical black bow or a canary-yellow silk shirt with a scarlet tie, fling it on the floor and put it on again with slow dignity while he bellowed his anger like Jeremiah cursing Jerusalem or like a sick cow mourning its kidnapped young. There came to him stockbrokers, labor leaders, distillers, anti-vivisectionists, vegetarians, disbarred shyster lawyers, missionaries to China, lobbyists for oil and electricity, advocates of war and of war against war. "Gaw, every guy in the country with a bad case of the gimmies comes to see me," he growled to Saracen. He promised to further their causes, to get an appointment to West Point for the nephew who had just lost his job in the creamery. He promised fellow politicians to support their bills if they would support his. He gave interviews upon subsistence farming, backless bathing suits, and the secret strategy of the Ethiopian army. He grinned and knee-patted and back-slapped, and few of his visitors, once they had talked with him, failed to look upon him as their little father and to support him forever. The few who did fail, most of them newspapermen, disliked the smell of him more than before they had met him. Even they, by the unusual spiritedness and color of their attacks upon him, kept his name alive in every column. By the time he had been a senator for 1 year, his machine was as complete and smooth-running, and as hidden away from ordinary passengers, as the engines of a liner. On the beds in many of his suites there would, at the same time, repose 3 top hats, 2 clerical hats, a green object with a feather, a brown derby, a taxi driver's cap, and 9 ordinary Christian brown felts. Once, within 27 minutes, he talked on the telephone from Chicago to Palo Alto, Washington, Buenos Aires, Wilmette, and Oklahoma City. Once, in 30 minutes, he received 16 calls from clergymen asking him to condemn the dirty burlesque show, and 7 from theatrical promoters and real estate owners asking him to praise it. He called the clergyman doctor or brother or both. He called the promoters buddy and pal. He gave equally ringing promises to both, and for both he loyally did nothing whatever. Normally he would not have thought of cultivating foreign alliances, though he never doubted that some day, as president, he would be leader of the world orchestra. Lee Saracen insisted that Buzz look into a few international fundamentals, such as the relationship of sterling to the lira, the proper way in which to address a baronet, the chances of the Archduke Otto, the London oyster bars, and the brothels near the Boulevard de Sebastopol, best to recommend to junketing representatives. But the actual cultivation of foreign diplomats resident in Washington he left to Saracen, who entertained them on terrapin and canvas-back duck with blackcurrant jelly, in his apartment that was considerably more tapestried than Buzz's own ostentatiously simple Washington quarters. However, in Saracen's place, a room with a large silk-hung Empire double bed was reserved for Buzz. It was Saracen who had persuaded Windrip to let him write 0 hour, based on Windrip's own dictated notes, and who had beguiled millions into reading, and even thousands into buying, that Bible of economic justice. Saracen, who had perceived there was now such a spate of private political weeklies and monthlies that it was a distinction not to publish one, Saracen, who had the inspiration for Buzz's emergency radio address at 3 a.m. upon the occasion of the Supreme Court's throttling the NRA in May 1935. Though not many adherents, including Buzz himself, were quite certain as to whether he was pleased or disappointed, though not many actually heard the broadcast itself, everyone in the country except sheepherders and Professor Albert Einstein heard about it and was impressed. Yet it was Buzz who all by himself thought of first offending the Duke of York by refusing to appear at the embassy dinner for him in December 1935, thus gaining in all farm kitchens and parsonages and barrooms a splendid reputation for homespun democracy, and of later mollifying His Highness by calling on him with a touching little home bouquet of geraniums from the hothouse of the Japanese ambassador, which endeared him, if not necessarily to royalty, yet certainly to the DAR, the English-speaking union, and all motherly hearts who thought the pudgy little bunch of geraniums too sweet for anything. By the newspaperman, Buzz was credited with having insisted on the nomination of Pearly Beecroft for vice president at the Democratic Convention, after Doremus Jessup had frenetically ceased listening. Beecroft was a southern tobacco planter and storekeeper, an ex-governor of his state, married to an ex-school teacher from Maine who was sufficiently scented with salt spray and potato blossoms to win any Yankee. But it was not his geographical superiority which made Mr. Beecroft the perfect running mate for Buzz Windrip, but that he was malaria-yellowed and laxly mustached, where Buzz's horsey face was ruddy and smooth, while Beecroft's oratory had a vacuity a profundity of slowly enunciated nonsense, which beguiled such solemn deacons as were irritated by Buzz's cataract of slang. Nor could Saracen ever have convinced the wealthy that the more Buzz denounced them and promised to distribute their millions to the poor, the more they could trust his common sense and finance his campaign. But with a hint, a grin, a wink, a handshake, Buzz could convince them, and their contributions came in by the 100,000, often disguised as assessments on imaginary business partnerships. It had been the peculiar genius of Berzelius Windrip not to wait until he should be nominated for this office or that to begin shanghaiing his band of buccaneers. He had been coaxing in supporters ever since the day when, at the age of 4, he had captivated a neighborhood comrade by giving him an ammonia pistol, which later he thriftily stole back from the comrade's pocket. Buzz might not have learned, perhaps could not have learned, much from sociologists Charles Beard and John Dewey, but they could have learned a great deal from Buzz. And it was Buzz's, not Saracen's, masterstroke that, as warmly as he advocated everyone's getting rich by just voting to be rich, he denounced all fascism and Nazism, so that most of the Republicans who were afraid of democratic fascism, and all the Democrats who were afraid of Republican fascism, were ready to vote for him. Chapter 10. While I hate befogging my pages with scientific technicalities and even neologies, I feel constrained to say here that the most elementary perusal of The Economy of Abundance would convince any intelligent student that the Cassandras who miscall the much-needed increase in the fluidity of our currential circulation inflation, erroneously basing their parallel upon the inflationary misfortunes of certain European nations in the era 1919 to 1923, fallaciously and perhaps inexcusably fail to comprehend the different monetary status in America inherent in our vastly greater reservoir of natural resources. 0 hour, Berzelius Windrip. Most of the mortgaged farmers, most of the white-collar workers who had been unemployed these 3 years and 4 and 5, most of the people on relief rolls who wanted more relief, most of the suburbanites who could not meet the installment payments on the electric washing machine. Such large sections of the American Legion as believed that only Senator Windrip would secure for them and perhaps increase the bonus. Such popular Myrtle Boulevard or Elm Avenue preachers as, spurred by the examples of Bishop Prang and Father Coughlin, believed they could get useful publicity out of supporting a slightly queer program that promised prosperity without anyone's having to work for it. The remnants of the Ku Klux Klan, and such leaders of the American Federation of Labor as felt they had been inadequately courted and bepromised by the old-line politicians, and the non-unionized common laborers who felt they had been inadequately courted by the same AF of L. Backstreet and over-the-garage lawyers who had never yet wangled governmental jobs. The Lost Legion of the Anti-Saloon League, since it was known that, though he drank a lot, Senator Windrip also praised teetotalism a lot, while his rival, Walt Trowbridge, though he drank but little, said nothing at all in support of the messiahs of Prohibition. These messiahs had not found professional morality profitable of late, with the Rockefellers and Wanamakers no longer praying with them nor paying. Besides these necessitous petitioners, a goodish number of burghers who, while they were millionaires, yet maintained that their prosperity had been sorely checked by the fiendishness of the bankers in limiting their credit. These were the supporters who looked to Berzelius Windrip to play the divine raven and feed them handsomely when he should become president, and from such came most of the fervid elocutionists who campaigned for him through September and October. Pushing in among this mob of camp followers who identified political virtue with money for their rent came a flying squad who suffered not from hunger but from congested idealism, intellectuals and reformers, and even rugged individualists, who saw in Windrip, for all his clownish swindlerism, a free vigor which promised a rejuvenation of the crippled and senile capitalistic system. Upton Sinclair wrote about Buzz and spoke for him just as